Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. This week, Salisbury University history professor Dean Kotlowski looks at President Richard Nixon's civil rights policies. Professor Kotlowski discusses the dichotomy of President Nixon's conservative speeches and his liberal-leaning policies. This is an hour.
All right, what we're going to do is continue our discussion of Richard Nixon here today, looking in particular at his civil rights program and policies. I'm going to start in and talk a little bit about a theme that we've discussed before, the idea of deeds versus words, that kind of dichotomy with Richard Nixon. His liberal deeds and his conservative words. We have experienced this before. When we talked about things that he did in the area of welfare, right? Social welfare, the environment, wage and price controls, very liberal policies. At the same time, he wooed middle America with conservative gestures, conservative words, if you will, social issues. We mentioned abortion somewhat, right? Anti-crime, law and order, patriotism, anti-pornography, that sort of thing. We've discussed that dichotomy before. Now we're going to deal with it in the area of civil rights. This is what the administration actually did. Okay, liberal deeds or moderate deeds. It desegregated Southern schools. It agreed to a strengthened Voting Rights Act. It implemented affirmative action and what are called set-asides for minority-owned companies. So all of that I will go over in a few minutes, more toward the end of class, with respect to the economic policies. It reformed Native American policy, or federal Indian policy. We will talk a little more about that in a few weeks. Okay, we're mainly going to look at African American issues today. At the same time, the president courted conservative Southern whites, and he strongly opposed busing. And again, more toward the middle of the lecture, I'm going to talk about busing and why busing was important and give you at least a sense of his rhetoric in that way. So overall, and I really like this quotation a great deal, overall the administration's enforcement of civil rights recalled Leonard Garment, who was a liberal Nixon aide and also a close personal friend of Nixon's in the White House. The policies were, as Garment put it, for the most part operationally progressive, but obscured by clouds of retrogressive rhetoric. So there he's making the point that you've heard me make before and now here about liberal deeds and conservative words. So what we'll do is look at Nixon's motivations on civil rights, and then I'm going to look at some of his policies with respect to school desegregation, affirmative action, minority businesses, and then summarize a little bit. And we're also going to have a little bit of discussion and interaction. And I'm going to do a little bit of storytelling, so you'll hear me go off on a tangent here, but as you've heard me say before, I'm allowed to go off on tangents when I know I'm doing it. And you'll see that, I think, very, very well. All right, why such a mixed record? Conservative words and liberal deeds. Look at the different motivations he has on civil rights. First motivation is political expediency. We have to remember here that Richard Nixon was primarily a politician. So politics and political considerations are going to be his number one priority. And what I want you guys to notice here, too, is that there is going to be with Richard Nixon a diminished emphasis on his part towards securing the African-American vote. All right? As you see here on the outline of the PowerPoint, this was partly a product of his record as vice president, partly a result of the outcome of the 1960 election, and partly a result of African Americans' loyalty to the party of FDR. All of that is saying this in a nutshell. In the 50s, Vice President Nixon had a good civil rights record. Okay? In 1960, he gets 32% of the African American vote. That's a lot for a Republican. But it wasn't enough to win the election, as we all know. And so there was a conclusion that Nixon made, that other Republicans also made, which said that you can't win the African American vote. It's too loyal to the Democratic Party. So what Nixon starts to see is the potential for greater breakthroughs among conservative white Southern voters. Conservative white Southern voters had historically been part of the Democratic Party, part of the Democratic coalition, and increasingly they were up for grabs. All right? In part, this was a result of the civil rights revolution of the 1960s. And in part, it was because the Republican Party was itself growing more conservative and the Democratic Party itself was growing more liberal. So these conservative white Southern voters would have, in other words, found a more natural home in the Republican Party than in the Democratic Party. So you want to kind of keep that in mind. Civil rights and race play an important role here. When President Lyndon Johnson signs the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and remember Johnson is a Democrat, he allegedly remarked offhandedly, "Well, I've just delivered the South to the Republican Party." So there was a real opportunity here. It didn't take a genius, an opportunity for Republicans, it didn't take a genius to figure that out. But Nixon had figured it out. I think this is important for you guys to make some notes on. Definitions of this Southern strategy, as it was called by some. Nixon, in his memoirs and elsewhere, has spoken of a national strategy. He always denied having a Southern strategy. He said, "We didn't have a Southern strategy, we had a national strategy," which for the first time included rather than excluded the South. And revisionist scholars such as myself write of what is called a symbolic Southern strategy, that he wooed white Southerners more with token gestures than with conservative or even racist policies. Now, what does that mean? In a nutshell, it means that Nixon, for political reasons, wooed the white South with appointments, with, like I said, gestures, but he did not at the same time purchase white Southern support with a wholesale retreat from civil rights enforcement. In other words, he didn't exchange civil rights for white Southern votes. He played it both ways. As a result, Southerners get appointments to the administration in key posts, or maybe not so key posts, actually. They get a few efforts to modify school desegregation deadlines and timetables. All the while, Nixon is going to muffle or downplay his accomplishments in the area of civil rights. Okay? So again, deeds versus words. A lot of the words and the public gestures will be geared toward the white South, and not toward African Americans. I should say this, with respect to appointments to the administration, the most famous thing that Nixon did or tried to do is he tried to put a white Southern conservative on the U.S. Supreme Court. The first attempt was a man named Clement Haynsworth. You don't have to write this down, it's in the book. Haynsworth was rejected by the Senate. So Nixon tried to find somebody who was even more conservative and someone who actually had a past that was somewhat racist, a guy named G. Harold Carswell, tried to put him on the court. Same opening as Haynsworth, you know, same vacant seat. Senate rejected Carswell, and Nixon actually had to appoint a northern conservative who turned out to not be so conservative. So I think that this would have been something that was something less than substantive, something that was more substantive if it had gotten through, if he'd got a member of the Supreme Court who was a white Southern conservative, you know. The court obviously has a substantive role in our lives in terms of what it does for us, this, that, and the other thing. But I think what was symbolism here was that Nixon was looking for a Southern conservative. And although he failed, the South literally was applauding him and thought it was a good try. So he got a lot of political support, I think, in the South, a lot of political capital by trying to put a Southerner on the court. Let's just take a look at some documents here. about Nixon's political agenda. And I think what we will do is we'll start here in the corner of the room and get a little bit of audience participation in here. This is document number one. This is a memorandum from Vice President Nixon to one of his aides. And I found this very interesting. I have not seen this cited anywhere. So, Chris, you get to enlighten us. What is Nixon telling this aide? Read the first two paragraphs, if you would, please.
Contact that civil rights group that has been wanting to come in to see me and tell them that I would like to see them, but that I'm completely booked this week or whenever they have asked for, but that I could work it out at another time. Offer them a date after January 27th. Bill Rogers tells me that they will not get this particular group together again, so I think we can get it out of this way. If they, by settling for a date after January 27th, I will be stuck with it.
Okay, Eric, the next two, please.
Tell them I have to go to Florida and have commitments that I just can't break between now and then. You could also tell them that I wanted them to know that I have talked to the Attorney General about it and that he and I share the same views on this thing, and I will get a complete fill-in from the Attorney General as far as this meeting is concerned.
Okay. You've all looked at these before, you know, over break since our last class. How does Nixon come across in this document? What sort of words would come to mind in terms of the sort of person he was? Anyone?
Sort of deceitful.
How so?
That it doesn't really bother him to lie to them about what he's doing.
All right. Anything else?
Along with that, even thought this really sneaky.
Okay. So we could use deceitful, sneaky here. Telling a little bit of a social lie that I've got to go to Florida, right? What does it say about his commitment to civil rights? If you were just to read this document in isolation. Anything come to mind, Chris?
He's only committed to it for political reasons.
Okay, for political reasons, how so?
That he doesn't want to blatantly say he won't meet with them, but right. Instead he's pushing it off just to make it like he still supports it.
I mean, that's a very good point. It's almost like he's trying to have his cake and eat it too, right? You know, he doesn't want to meet with the group, but he doesn't want the group to be mad at him either. Right? That last paragraph I think is kind of interesting too. You could also tell them that I wanted them to know that I've talked to the Attorney General about it. I believe what they're talking about here is a Civil Rights Act that was very weak that passed in 1960 that dealt with voting rights. And you notice here he's basically saying, look guys, tell the civil rights group that I'm in favor of this voting rights law. So he, again, Chris, I think that's a good point. He is trying to have it a number of different ways. And the document is interesting. But that social lie, that sneakiness, as Morgan was saying, I think is really what struck me about this document. You know, it's like, here I'm sneaky and deceitful. I'll put it down in paper so the historian later on can discover this. Let's take a look at a few other things. This is a cartoon. I believe this is from the 1960s, and it kind of illustrates what I was getting at using a sort of water metaphor here. The Republican Party fishing in southern waters for votes. Okay. Nixon himself had his own water metaphor. He said with respect to the South that that's where the ducks are. So that's, in other words, where we're going to go hunting for support. And I wonder how this document here is a letter from Strom Thurmond to Richard Nixon. And this is document number two. And Mike, I'm going to have you read the first two paragraphs right after Dear Dick.
Closing for your perusal several newspaper articles and editorials which followed my announcement June 13th supporting your candidacy for president. If we are to win in South Carolina and other southern states, it will be necessary to deal carefully with Wallace, the Wallace movement. I believe your comments in Atlanta concerning Governor Wallace were sound, and I think that it would be wise to stay with this position rather than to be drawn into public statements which be unnecessarily antagonize Wallace supporters.
Sarita, you want to read the next one and then try to decipher Nixon's handwriting for us?
The news media in my state, including radio, TV, and newspapers, gave wide distribution to my statement, and I believe we are off to a good start in carrying South Carolina for the GOP this fall. With kindest regards.
Nixon's response up there, he's got his handwritten response. He's starting a letter, a response to Strom Thurmond.
Will be decisive in reducing I think it's like the Wallace vote.
Yeah, the Wallace vote, exactly. So again, he replies, "Dear Strom, many thanks. You will be decisive in reducing the Wallace vote." So what do we have going on here? Before you respond to this, let me just say that Strom Thurmond would have been probably the most prominent Southern Republican in this period. He had been a Democrat. He'd been an independent. He was a Republican at this point, and he was a senator from South Carolina, and he would serve as senator from South Carolina up until your lifetime. I think he died around 2004. So he's going to be around for a good deal of time. What does this document say about the relationship between Nixon and Thurmond? How would you kind of characterize it? Any thoughts come to mind? John?
I mean, I just think they seem kind of close. To begin with, Thurmond keeps saying, or he calls him Dick at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then he keeps saying we, and kind of emphasizes that they're kind of like partners working together to get the South vote and
okay.
get rid of Wallace's votes.
Okay, that's a good point. I'm also kind of curious, though, this is what Thurmond is in essence offering him, you know, his support and his assistance. But do you guys see any specific promises in this letter?
Nixon doesn't promise anything in return. He just kind of gives him thanks, and that's about it.
Okay, all right. So in a way, I think that's a good point. You don't see anything. There were some promises that were made with respect to Nixon helping South Carolina in terms of its textile industry, all right? And he admitted that in his memoir. But I think you guys are both right. I think John's right. There is a certain friendly aura to the letter, but there is, at the same time, I think no specific promises being made. And I think, John, actually, we're up to you. And here we'll sort of jump ahead a little bit, 3 years into the White House, and see what this document says and tells us a little bit about the so-called Southern strategy. So you can read the first paragraph, and then Chris can read the second. This is from Nixon to Al Haig, who had been on Kissinger's staff, who was in the military. So he's talking to a military man.
It occurred to me that as far as the memorial to the dead who fought on the Southern side of the Civil War is concerned, that perhaps a good way to handle it would be to have a memorial to Lee and Grant. Both were graduates of West Point, both were outstanding generals on their side during the war, and both handled themselves in the best tradition of opposing generals at the conclusion of the war.
Chris?
It may not be possible to get any kind of memorial of this type at West Point, but I have a strong feeling that erecting something either to Lee or to other West Point graduates who fought and died on the Southern side could have a dramatic effect in healing some of the wounds in the South that still exist 100 years after the war is completed.
Okay. Now this, I think, is interesting on a whole host of levels. How does this maybe reflect or maybe not reflect what I have said a little earlier about Nixon's political strategy with respect to the South? Anyone? Let's see. Christy?
He's setting up for the South by giving them those memorials.
Okay, he is in one level sucking up to the South, as you put it, by giving the memorial. There's a memorial to Lee. Christopher?
Well, I was just going to say that because he wants to do Lee and Grant, he's sort of sticking with his national strategy, but it's sort of subtly more of a Southern strategy.
Okay, all right. Also, too, about this, how important do you think this memorial is in the big scheme of things? Mike? So how would that maybe jive with what we were saying about his strategies?
Just basically just going like against it, like just kind of playing him off as like he's with them, but not really.
Okay, all right. So this strikes me as something very symbolic that he wants to do. Do you see this as something political here in terms of what he's doing? Morgan, you're kind of nodding your head.
I think that he'll make the white Southerners happy if he does a memorial for him, and so that's what he wants to do so that they'll vote for him.
In terms of Nixon's motivations on anything, what is it always a good safe bet to assume? Huh?
Politics.
Yeah, that there's some sort of political angle here. But one of the things I want you guys to know is that there's also, you know, he is a human being. He's multifaceted and multidimensional. I don't necessarily want to defend him on this, but his great-grandfather did actually fight in the Civil War on the side of the North. He was from Ohio, and he died at Gettysburg. Now, let me ask you this question. How many of you have been to Gettysburg? It's part of maybe a family trip. All right, I took History Club at SU there a few years ago, And before that, I went myself, and I got one of those self-guided tours, or one of those guided tours, I should say, where you get an individualized tour with a park ranger, and it's individualized from the park ranger's standpoint, from his perspective or her perspective. They do their own tour, they make it up, and this guy was particularly good, and he was particularly dramatic, and he led us to about three gravestones and told the stories behind them. One of the gravestones, of all people, who do I get on this tour? George Nixon. And it turned out, he says George Nixon is from Ohio. He says George Nixon, I think, was in his 40s when he volunteered and when he served. Okay, and from what I remember, the guide said that he had something like 8 or 9 kids and he was married. So the speculation was he joined the army to get away from all of the screaming, hollering kids and things like that. And he died doing picket duty, a kind of guard duty, at Gettysburg. And then the park ranger very dramatically said, now that name Nixon, where have I heard that name Nixon before? And it turned out this was the great-grandfather of Richard Nixon and Nixon's own daughter, Julie Nixon Eisenhower, who's married to David Eisenhower, we were told, lives in Pennsylvania. And she would come every Memorial Day with flowers and put them on what would be her great-great-grandfather's grave. So there is this element as well in terms of healing that maybe Nixon, from his own personal, familial, and biographical perspective, would have been interested in doing. Let's take a look at the practical considerations he had on civil rights, because I think, again, this is very interesting and very, very important. By practical, I refer to how Nixon governed the country on a day-to-day basis. Okay? How he governed the country on a day-to-day basis, how he dealt with challenges on a daily basis. And this is what I want you guys to remember. I call Nixon and his aides, his subordinates, the Nixonians. All right? And I think at their core, they were realists and improvisers who understood the national mood, the problems at hand, and the alignment of political forces. They were understanders, folks, and these were the things they understood. They knew that the Vietnam War had undermined confidence in government. They knew that Lyndon Johnson's Great Society had failed to end the twin nightmares of racism and poverty, and white backlash against civil rights was brewing and was erupting. They also knew that support for racial integration remained high among African American and white liberals, while at the same time, many African Americans had turned or were turning to separatist ideas and doctrines. So what Nixon and his team understood here was that liberalism was down but not out. Okay, liberalism was down but not out. And they knew that there were civil rights advocates literally all over Washington in interest groups like the NAACP, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. They were present in the bureaucracy. And they were present also in the federal judiciary. So there was a lot of sentiment in favor of traditional, expansive, liberal policies in the context in which Nixon governed. This is something familiar to you all. We've discussed this before. Facing a Democrat-controlled Congress and a Republican Party that was torn or divided between moderates and conservatives, Nixon declined to follow either a purely liberal or purely conservative course. And I think that that's very important. And again, that sense of zigzagging, to some extent we saw that with some of his other policies and programs. So this would be part two here. You know, politics is important, but there are certain practical considerations he has to balance. All right? You know, when Nixon signed a strengthened and revised Voting Rights Act, he did so with some reluctance, and he made the comment to his aides, you know, we have an obligation to prevent the goddamn country from blowing up. You know, that was some sort of quotation that he had. He was a little angry at that point. Philosophy is the third set of motivations for Richard Nixon. Or what were Nixon's principles? Now, we don't think of Richard Nixon necessarily as having principles. I'll tell you a little story. When I was writing my dissertation, and I was well along into it, I ran into a fellow graduate student in the basement of the Indiana University Library, and we compared notes as to how we were doing with our dissertations and where we stood. And this guy was very bright, he was very able, and he was an intellectual historian, and I said, you know, right now I'm trying to wrestle with Richard Nixon's principles. And he said, I never think of Richard Nixon as having any principles. What I would say is this: every person in this room, on this planet, has some kind of principles, all right? Some kind of idea as to how the world works or at how it ought to work. And so I would say here, philosophy is a set of assumptions, not a static ideology, from which Nixon and his aides referenced and reacted to events. Okay, it's a set of assumptions. It's not a static ideology from which these Nixonians, again, are going to reference and react to events, events at the grassroots. What can we say about these guys? Well, they sensed that the American system was under fire from various dissenters. And so these Nixonians offered, in response, to extend the opportunities they had known to minority groups, to disadvantaged groups. We've got to remember who Nixon and his aides were. His cabinet, the members of administration. They were largely self-made men who had risen to leadership positions in the fields of business, law, and politics. And as such, they very naturally extolled opportunity, hard work, and success. So you might want to put this in your notes and, you know, make a special notation of this. The people who were in Nixon's administration, it was largely a white male administration, they may not have been for civil rights, but they were for equal opportunity. You know, that was a kind of reference, that was a kind of language or terminology that they could understand. And this is very important. They were moderate Republicans who would use the power of the state, who would use the power of the federal government selectively to open up a range of choices to their fellow citizens. So I have state power down there. I'm not meaning the 50 states of the United States, but I mean the state as an institution of governance, the national government here in this case. So they would use the power, federal power, but on a selective basis, where they thought they could make an impact and improve people's lives. And folks, I think this is very important, and you'll see this playing out as we look at Nixon's actual policies. Nixon proposed to lift disadvantaged groups into higher paying jobs. All right? He really believed that integration, racial integration, should be enforced in the workplace, not in schools or neighborhoods. Okay? So I think he saw a job strategy, okay, integrating the workplace, giving African Americans and other minority groups and other disadvantaged groups access to good-paying jobs as more politically palatable to the country, more politically palatable to the white community, if you will. And I think that there was a program here for gradual integration of the other areas. The idea was that if African Americans got access to higher education, they got access to good jobs, they would have the earning power to move into good neighborhoods, and therefore they would have good primary and secondary schools. And that would be done on a very gradual basis. And I think in a nutshell, that was Nixon's vision with respect to civil rights. I'm going to turn here just to kind of a side issue that I think is interesting. It's somewhat tangential to philosophy or principles. It is not in the outline that I passed out, but I think it's interesting and important, and that is, what were Nixon's views on race? As you can imagine, they were not always terribly progressive. He was born in 1913, the year that the Wilson administration introduced segregation into the federal civil service. He was 34 years old when the first African American played Major League Baseball. And he was 41 when the Supreme Court declared that segregated schools were unconstitutional. At best, you can say he was a man of contradictions. What else, right? You know, this is Richard Nixon for you. A man of contradictions, a man of complexity. In private, he could be as racist as any Southern segregationist. He actually asserted to one of his aides that, quote, there has never been an adequate black nation, and they are the only race of which this is true, end quote. All right? I think he probably needed to take a course in world civilizations and learn about the Kingdom of Ghana and the Kingdom of Mali, but his educational training did not extend to those subjects. We also find examples of Nixon using racial slurs, okay? Not repeatedly, not relentlessly, not intensively, but they do crop up against African Americans, Jewish Americans, Mexican Americans in particular. So they are there, and it's something that you have to come to terms with. But I think this is important. This self-made man, Richard Nixon, differed from the segregationists in believing that blacks deserve the opportunity to compete with whites. He actually told his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, in 1971, it's clear that not everybody is equal, but we must ensure that anyone might go to the top. So this is the way I put it when I was writing my book. Nixon himself, at his core, I think, doubted African-American equality. He doubted female equality with men. Okay? But he still believed these groups should have the right to, or the opportunity to compete, because some of them might be good. Now, that's not necessarily a positive, completely positive, or completely progressive perspective. But it was the perspective of someone of his generation and his outlook. We also have to remember that Nixon was a Quaker, and I think that's important for you guys to write down and note. And Quakerism had a strong anti-slavery egalitarian tradition. And I think this is very interesting, too, that Nixon, he was personally and private comfortable with African Americans. And politically, he was comfortable with the issue of civil rights. I'll give you three examples here. And you don't have to write these down if you don't want to, but I think the stories are very interesting. In the 1950s, when he was vice president, he did meet a few times with Martin Luther King Jr., and King was very impressed with Nixon's commitment to civil rights. And King allegedly said that if Richard Nixon is not sincere, he is the most dangerous man in America. He was comfortable with members of his administration who were African-American. That really shouldn't surprise you. But one of these White House staffers, an African-American woman, told me a story about Nixon in 1972. It was after the 1972 elections. And Nixon was going to fire everybody in the administration, pretty much, which included those who were African-American. He was going to start fresh. Everyone was going to lose their jobs. So he met with his African-American appointees, and he entered the room. It was supposed to be a brief meeting. It was supposed to last 15 minutes. It lasted well over an hour. She described Nixon as being relaxed and self-confident, completely at ease, supportive. He offered advice to the African-American appointees. He said, it's important you do things that are not related to civil rights, you know, in your professional careers, as well as those that are related to civil rights. He seemed to be fawning over, she said, this woman named Jewel LaFont, who was an African-American woman, and Nixon had her kind of pegged out to be on the federal court. He wanted to appoint her to a lower court so that someday he could possibly appoint her to the U.S. Supreme Court and be the first president to appoint the first woman to the U.S. Supreme Court and the first African-American woman to the Supreme Court. Now, that never happened, but it's very interesting. And this aide told me, she said, "I have never been in a room with a white male politician of Nixon's generation where the white male politician made not one single slip up." About a year or so, a couple years actually before that, Nixon had a meeting at the White House with Whitney Young, who was president of the National Urban League. All right. There had been a lot of tension between the Nixon administration and civil rights leaders, because civil rights leaders did not like the rhetoric coming out of the White House. They were suspicious of this so-called Southern strategy. Whitney Young had been very critical of the administration, even though Young was interested in economic development issues that really dovetailed what Nixon wanted to do in this area for African Americans and other minorities. So 1970 elections don't go great for Nixon. The White House arranges a meeting. It offers, in other words, an olive branch to Whitney Young and his group. And Whitney Young and members of the National Urban League have this meeting at the White House with Nixon and with higher echelon figures in the Nixon administration. They come in. The president sits down. Jokes are exchanged. Whitney Young says, "You know, we're in a lot of financial trouble. We may need to get a new president." And Nixon says, "You mean, of course, a new president of the Urban League." Young pointed to one of his aides, a young woman, and said, "Can I have her start the presentation?" Nixon said, "Well, I'm not going to get in trouble with the women's liberation crowd." So she started. The National Urban League listed a number of grants that they wanted for specific job training and economic development projects that they were undertaking. They wanted federal grants. They wanted money. Nixon said, "Yes, yes, 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 yes." He ticked off all of this and literally said at the end, "Is there anything else I can do for you?" Young said something along the lines of, "Can you call me in a month to make sure all of this is going to be handled?" Nixon said, he pointed to one of his aides, "I will have him call you in a month and make sure that all of this is in the pipeline and it's going to be handled. Anything else, gentlemen?" They said no, and they got up and left. And one of Whitney Young's aides was heard to mutter under his breath, "It pays to go to the top." Bradley H. Patterson, Jr., who was one of Nixon's aides and one of the finest men who worked in the administration, you know, a kind of really a pillar of selflessness and integrity and hard work and moderate to liberal principles on the issue of race, again, took notes on this and then editorialized at the very end, and we have the document. Patterson wrote, quote, "The president was really great," end quote. So you have that, and you kind of have to kind of match that against the other things that Nixon said that are maybe not so pleasant and not so nice. Let's look at some more of his motivations on the issue of civil rights. And we're going to go back a little bit in time here. And I'll read, this is a letter to this Mr. Clark, Leonard Clark, July 22nd, 1960. And Lucy, could you read the first?
"Dear Mr. Clark, although some time has elapsed since your thoughtful letter to me, I want you to know that it did not go unnoticed. I appreciate this opportunity to give you my views concerning civil rights. Basically, I believe in working for full opportunity for all our citizens, regardless of race, creed, or ancestry. To me, there are three compelling reasons for this position."
Okay, Morgan, you can go ahead here. First,
"The real reason for America's greatness is the fact that we have always believed in freedom and opportunity for all. We fought for our independence to secure political freedom. We welcome millions of immigrants, many of them fleeing religious, political, or economic persecution, and made of them one nation strong and resolute."
Okay, let's stop right there just to kind of digest, especially that first paragraph that where he's, or first reason that Nixon's explaining. Anything strike you as being particularly interesting there? Or noteworthy at all? Or does it sound more standard stock type stuff? Anyone have any thoughts? Mandy?
I thought it was interesting that he's apologizing for, like, the lack of response, but in the first document we read, it talks about him trying to put it off.
Trying to?
Put off the concern for civil rights
Okay, right, 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 putting off the concern. And here you see the other side of him, right, where he seems to be much more gung-ho. Okay, anything else? Just taking a look. It's good to match the documents with each other. Morgan?
I feel like everything he's saying as far as that, like, first reason is very, like, rehearsed and typical.
Okay.
And it's not personal.
Right. The only thing I agree with, the only thing that sort of strikes me about all of this is one nation strong and resolute. I'm thinking here as a child of the Cold War, that he's thinking of the Cold War. So, but I think it sounds like 4th of July type things that you would hear in a speech. Mandy, the second thing he points to here.
Second, to me, it is morally wrong to segregate human beings on the basis of race. Praise or blame, acceptance or rejection should be personal matters based upon individual achievement and not the accident of color or birth. I could not accept Hitler's idea of a master race, and I cannot accept the equally false principle of an inferior race.
Okay. Now, there's something in there that strikes me as interesting, and I don't know if it strikes you guys as interesting as well. He's, again, trying to flesh out his views on civil rights, why he's in favor of civil rights. What does he cite here? Yeah?
The one part that was kind of weird was he said, and not the accident of their color or birth.
Okay.
He's kind of like, I know he's talking about race not mattering, but that statement to me, it just seems like it does matter to him.
Yeah, it does. And also the idea of accident. You know, there's something negative about that, right? Anything else? Who makes an appearance here? Hitler, okay. And where there's Hitler, there's the Holocaust. So you want to kind of think about Nixon generationally. I said what he would have experienced. He would have experienced World War II. He would have, you know, seen the images of the Holocaust. And he would have seen, like a lot of liberal-minded Americans saw, that this is, to a certain extent, what happens when you take racism to an extreme. So it's interesting that he has that perspective as well. Allison, I think this might be the most interesting part of all, finally.
Finally, I'm deeply concerned with the impact of racial division in terms of world power. Most of the people of the world belong to the colored races. They deeply resent any slurs based on race. If we of the United States are considered as racist, then we may lose the communist camp hundreds of millions of potential friends and allies. That would leave us disastrously isolated in a hostile world.
Anything there that strike you guys as kind of noteworthy or important? Chris?
Well, it seems like the most emotional and passionate paragraph of the whole thing. He uses a lot of emotional words.
Such as?
Deeply concerned and deeply resent. A disastrously isolated and hostile world.
Okay, I think that's very interesting. Would you say, though, the argument he is making here is a principled or a moral one in terms of supporting civil rights? And I don't necessarily mean that to you, but you can answer it if you want. I mean, is he making his case on moral grounds here, Mike?
It's probably a principle because he's talking about, like, going against, like, the communists and stuff and that you need to be, like, not racist or, like, because communism is all, like, everyone's equal and not equal.
Okay, so he is citing a principle here, right? But for what purpose?
It seems like his, the issue he's most passionate about is political.
Political, you think? Yeah, and here it would be a kind of geopolitical reason, right? He doesn't, I think this is very practical. We, meaning the United States, doesn't want to lose support in Africa and Asia. So what he's doing here is this would leave us disastrously isolated in a hostile world. So there's a certain reality here. Morgan, you want to read the last paragraph here?
I know that it is difficult to change patterns that have prevailed for many years, but we must make this difficult decision or fail to live up to the sacred ideals of our nation.
And again, when you look at a sentence like that, would you say that was more principle, practical, or political? Look at how he begins it, and I'll read it for you again. I know that it is difficult to change patterns that have prevailed for many years, but we must make this difficult decision or fail to live up to the sacred ideals of our nation. What do you think? Kayla?
It's probably really personal because he probably has a hard time with it as well.
Okay.
He like knows how hard it is to change something that's been going on forever.
Okay. Any other thoughts? I'm kind of wondering here when he says difficult to change pattern, I think he's preparing the reader for this, that it's going to take a long time to change issues, problems related to civil rights and attitudes about race. And I what I hear there is Nixon the politician speaking. But you notice, and this goes, I think, back to Chris's point about some of the emotional language. Here you've got sacred ideals of the nation being mentioned. Overall, what kind of message did you get from this document? Did you think this is a very passionate document? Or does it strike you as a kind of form letter?
I think that at the beginning it was really moving and he seemed really passionate about fixing the problems as far as race is concerned in the country. But when it came to his last point, it kind of bothered me that all of a sudden he was talking about how the country as a whole looks to everyone else.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Any other points, any other questions here about this? You know, politicians will sometimes leave behind what are called posterity notes, designed to make them look good to historians and so on and so forth. And I see a lot of thinking going on here in this document. I see a lot of reasons being cited and so on and so forth. But I'm a little concerned here with respect to Richard Nixon that that this was maybe sort of assembled by his staff to answer the issue of civil rights and to make explanations. And I'm not sure that this is exactly his language, but I do think that it reflects his views. So I think that that's something that's kind of important and something you all can wrestle with. Let's look in the rest of the time we have today in class at three Nixon civil rights policies. Sometime we'll, a good deal of the portion of this discussion we'll spend on school desegregation. And then we'll look a little bit at affirmative action and minority businesses. So I think you can see Nixon's complex policy making and his motivations, his multiple motivations, emerging most clearly in respect to or with respect to school desegregation. The Supreme Court, beginning in 1954, pushed for the desegregation of Southern schools, okay, in the decision of Brown versus Board of Education. And you've all studied Brown versus Board of Education and heard of it in previous courses. The court ruled that segregated schools in the South were unconstitutional. Does anyone remember what the timetable was that the court set for desegregating the Southern schools? It's kind of a tricky question. Did the court set a timetable? Does anyone know? Actually, it did not. Has anybody ever heard of this phrase, with all deliberate speed? I see some people nodding their heads, right? That was what the court said in terms of the pacing of the progress for school desegregation. It was to occur with all deliberate speed, all right? With all deliberate speed meant with all deliberate delay in reality. And the schools were only desegregated on a very gradual and very, very minuscule basis going up until 1969. So the vast majority of Southern schools, when Nixon took office, were not desegregated. 15 years, a decade and a half after the Brown decision. Nixon tried to sound reasonable on school desegregation. This was probably the most thorny and difficult of all of the civil rights issues because it involved children. And it involved schools. And white Southerners wanted to hang on to their all-white schools, which were better financed and to a certain extent, therefore, better than the African-American schools. And they were also very fearful that when you started to put black and white kids together, they would become friends. And then they would maybe start to date, and then they would intermarry, and this was part of the sort of white racist fears in the South. So Nixon tries to sound reasonable, and he explained in a statement in 1969 that there are two extreme groups. There are those who want instant integration and those who want segregation forever. I believe we have to have a middle course. And I think this is also important and it should not surprise you. He always gauged the political fallout of his civil rights policies in general and his school desegregation efforts in particular. He actually told his aides, we have to do what's right, but we must separate that from politics and not be under the illusion that this is helping us politically. Interestingly enough, the energy for a renewed assault on segregation in the schools began where it started, in the federal courts. And this is the case I want you guys to write down and remember. 1969, the Supreme Court in Alexander versus Holmes County unanimously ordered southern school districts to desegregate at once. All right? So with all deliberate speed was thrown out. And in 1969, the U.S. Supreme Court in Alexander versus Holmes County unanimously ordered the South to desegregate its schools at once. The official terminology from the court's decision was that the districts were to terminate dual school systems at once. Dual school systems would have been black and white. And they were to operate hereafter only unitary school systems. So if Brown is important, but Alexander is also important. And Alexander occurred during Nixon's presidency. And you know that statement that I read to you from Nixon about wanting a middle course? This is a cartoon by the Washington Post cartoonist Herbert Block, better known as Herb Block. Shows Nixon being a political coward on the issue of race and civil rights and school desegregation. And the caption below reads, "Yes, sir, we'll issue some more statements on both sides of the question immediately." And there you notice in the background is Uncle Sam holding up a sign saying, "Wanted moral leadership." So here's how Nixon responded to the Alexander decision. It forced him to desegregate the southern school system much more quickly than he had anticipated. Okay? Much more quickly, I think, than he had hoped he would have to. Oops. He struggled to get ahead of the school desegregation question, and what he did was to limit the scope of the Alexander decision. And what I'm about to say, I think, is very, very important and very, very significant. Because Nixon is going to make an important distinction. He is going to distinguish between de jure and de facto segregation. De jure and de facto segregation. De jure segregation was segregation by law. It was segregation that consciously separated blacks from whites. So in which region of the country would we have had de jure segregation? What do you think? Anybody? The South, right, in the South. Okay. De facto segregation meant segregation in fact. Okay? Segregation, in other words, in daily practice, not necessarily by law. It happened when African Americans lived in one place and went to the local school, which would have been mainly black. And whites lived in another place, another locale, and went to a school that was largely white. De facto segregation was present in places in the South, but it's mainly present in the North. Okay? So you should write that down and remember it. De facto segregation is associated with the North, is a better way of putting it, vis-a-vis the South. What Nixon did was to tell his aides to do what the law requires. The law now is the Alexander decision. Okay? Do what the law requires, and not one bit more, and attack de jure segregation in the South, while ignoring as much as they could de facto segregation in the North. So I think that this is very important, and you guys should put a little star next to this in your notes. What Nixon was doing was promoting desegregation, eliminating formal de jure segregation. That's how he defined his policy. It was one of desegregation, eliminating formal or de jure segregation It was not an attack on de facto segregation. It was not an effort to consciously integrate the races. So Nixon, by his own admission, the words out of his own mouth, he is against forced integration of the races. It's a subtle distinction, maybe a little too subtle for some people at the time, some of his critics, but he made that distinction. And this is important. Now I'm going to tell you, you often hear in your courses about how the Brown decision came about. Well, this is how ultimately school segregation ends, or at least ends for a time in the United States. There's been a process of resegregation recently. But in 1970, Nixon formed a cabinet-level committee on education. All right? And what this cabinet committee did, it consisted of members of his administration. It was coordinated by his Secretary of Labor, a man named George Shultz, who later became Secretary of State of the United States. What this cabinet-level committee did was to form advisory committees of prominent African Americans and whites in 7 southern states to bring those states into compliance with the Alexander decision. In other words, to desegregate the schools of the South. The stress here was on negotiation and interracial cooperation. Again, each of those state-level committees that would have reported back to the cabinet committee would have had prominent African Americans and prominent white Americans. The stress was, again, on negotiation, interracial cooperation, not federal coercion. The cabinet committee assigned funds to help the process of desegregation in the South. And it even financed television advertisements to encourage respect for the law. I'll give you one example here. A close friend of Nixon's, the prominent Protestant minister, Reverend Billy Graham, was enlisted to do television advertisements in the South. He was a Southerner. He was from the Carolinas. And he did that, and that helped the process. You might want to make a special notation of this. I think what's going on here is very clear. The cabinet committee is going to subtly shift the debate from whether the South will desegregate to how the South will desegregate. And when we look at Southern school desegregation and we look at the Nixon record, what this cabinet committee run by Shultz did was to bring the federal government into the desegregation process as a partner, bring the executive branch into the desegregation process as a partner. But Nixon insisted that it remain a silent partner. You don't have to write this down, but these are some of the things he told his aides in private. He said, high-profile, overly aggressive federal actions will make the problem worse in the South. So they're looking at September 1970 for all of the schools of the South to open on a non-segregated basis. Nixon thought that grandstanding, bragging about all they were going to do in the South with desegregation, will, quote, get us no votes in the North while gravely abrading the entire South. There's Nixon the politician for you, right? Always gauging the impact of his political decisions. The president reminded subordinates not to make a big deal out of all we're doing. Quit bragging. Quietly do our job. Low profile is the key. And I've got to tell you, when you work in this area of civil rights and you work with the Nixon administration on this issue, and you're studying it, and you're heading toward 1970, when the schools are going to open across the South, there's a sense of drama and emotion that comes through. A month before the schools were going to open, this was around August 8th, August 9th, Nixon meets in private with all of his top domestic aides to discuss school desegregation. And he is worried about the threat of resistance in the South and the threat of violence. He no doubt was thinking back to 1957 when opposition to school desegregation at Little Rock Central High School forced President Dwight D. Eisenhower to send army troops into Little Rock to facilitate desegregation. For Nixon, he was about here to do something that no president had ever done, implement massive desegregation across the South. And he was no doubt worried, am I going to have 100 Little Rocks? Will I have to send troops into 100 places, 1,000 places? So he begins the meeting, and you can just sense the nervousness in his voice. First thing he says is very political. He says that this is a Washington, D.C. issue. There are no votes for us in desegregating the schools of the South. I could give the Sermon on the Mount, he says, and the NAACP would say the rhetoric wasn't good enough. But, he said, the law must be enforced. In that I am a firm believer. And he kept reminding his aides in this meeting over and over again. He kept telling them, you know, again, don't brag. You know, don't send any federal marshals into the South unless they're asked for. Everybody, just quietly do your job. We're here to help. One of his staff members said, well, should we talk about the guidelines? These were timetables and threats to cut off funding that had originated under President Johnson. Nixon looked at the person and said, don't ever use that word again, guidelines. Another aide outside of this meeting said, you know, they wanted to establish a kind of control center for the South, a kind of war room. Another aide said, don't call it by any means a war room. Call it a tranquility base. That was a reference to the moon landing. You know, they wanted everything to be as low-key as possible. But folks, behind the scenes, and you don't often see this, Nixon did exercise some leadership with respect to the White South. The State Advisory Committee for Louisiana was having troubles. The members of it were at loggerheads. So Nixon was called upon to go to the South. He didn't want to, and he said, you know, we'll do it because it'll help the schools. And he flew to Louisiana, went through the streets of, I think it was New Orleans, in an open car. People pulled the cufflinks off his shirt. It was almost like Bobby Kennedy in 1968. And he made some statement that we're here to treat the South with respect and dignity and as a part of the country. There again is all of the Southern strategy, the symbolism, the rhetoric geared toward the White South. The actual policy was desegregation. Okay? He met in private with the members of that Louisiana committee, and Nixon said to them, you can have good schools, you can have inferior schools, you can have no schools. It's up to you. And here's what happened. It worked. All right? It worked. The schools opened across the South on a non-segregated basis. And the numbers, you might want to write this down. I think they're important. 1968, 68% of African-American school children in the South attended all-black schools. In 1972, 8% attended such schools. Charles Evers of Mississippi, who was the brother of slain civil rights leader Medgar Evers, said at one point, wow, I got to hand it to that Nixon. He's really cracked down. There's not a school here in Mississippi that some black is not in. So in this sense, with respect to the South, at this moment in 1970, Nixon was the greatest school desegregator in American history. Busing was another story, and I won't go into all of the details of this, but his rhetoric was very strong against busing, and you see this in another Herb Lock cartoon. He actually tried to limit court decisions as much as he could with respect to supporting busing to, again, bus school children to achieve integration and to attack de facto segregation. That's something that Nixon wanted to avoid doing. And here what you have is Herb Lock very cleverly and very critically showing Nixon inflating this school bus threat, the threat of busing, as he had previously inflated the threat of Red China, Communist China. And the caption here is very revealing, I think. Take heart, ma'am. After he gets it inflated, he'll rescue you from it. All right? So we could spend more time on busing. But I think Nixon wanted to shift the debate a little bit and the emphasis of federal civil rights policy away from school desegregation, even voting rights to some extent, and towards strategies of economic development. And here's a quote for you guys to remember. I think it's important. During the internal debate on school desegregation within the administration, Nixon told his aides, remember, jobs are more important to Negroes than anything else. Okay? Remember, jobs are more important to Negroes than anything else. And I think this job strategy dated back to Nixon's years as vice president, when he chaired a committee to stop bias in companies that held government contracts. The civil rights leader James Farmer, years later, after Nixon's death, applauded him as the strongest president on affirmative action up to that point. And Fortune magazine at the time of Nixon's death proclaimed, incredible but true, it was the Nixonites who gave us employment quotas. How did it happen? Again, really briefly here, he supported something called the Philadelphia Plan. And the Philadelphia Plan was a program in which federal contractors in southeastern Pennsylvania would have to demonstrate good faith efforts at hiring minorities. So it really was a limited plan in the sense it only covered 6 counties in southeastern Pennsylvania. And if you were a federal contractor and you wanted to hold your federal contract, you had to make sure that you were hiring a certain numerical range of minorities. You had to at least show a good faith effort. Okay, I think the percentage was something like 10 to 18%, depending on the project and depending on the contract. Wasn't this a quota system? No, said the administration. Nixon said that their program was based on flexible goals and timetables, not rigid quotas. It's a distinction not everyone bought. But I think what Nixon was trying to say was, look, under our plan, you only have to show good faith at meeting these goals and targets and timetables. Under a quota system, you'd have to reach an actual number, and if you didn't, you'd lose your government contract. He, in some respects, I think, was creating a kind of straw man and defining his own policy as favorably as he could. Why did Nixon do this? I think that this was a way, this Philadelphia Plan was a way to enforce civil rights on normally Democratic-leaning unions. So here is a kind of Republican, if you will, civil rights program. It also allowed him to develop a civil rights program or initiative of his own and to calm potential rioting, which was something that had afflicted the 1960s, President Johnson, the administration in the 1960s, urban rioting. And here was a way of Nixon to kind of calm that potential, to quell potential rioting by promoting African American economic development and progress. Affirmative action was later extended by Nixon's subordinates. Interestingly, not Nixon himself. He kind of pulled back from the issue. But it was extended by his subordinates to all government contractors, which is a huge body of potential employers, a huge sector of the economy. It was also extended to the federal civil service and to institutions of higher education. And alongside this, you kind of have two halves of a walnut. You've got affirmative action, and then you've got minority business enterprise. Nixon, in 1968, in a couple of speeches called Bridges to Human Dignity, promoted the idea of black capitalism. Okay? And that meant black ownership of homes and businesses. And what Nixon is going to do as president is he will support, he's going to expand this a little bit, the definition. He's not going to call it black businesses, but minority businesses. So here is a way for Nixon really to appeal to folks who are Hispanic as well as African American. A lot of this coincided with some of the rhetoric of Malcolm X and with traditional pro-business principles in the Republican Party. It was practical because it offered poorer minorities, again, a piece of the action. That's a phrase from the time. And it bolstered the American system of free enterprise. And again, I think it was politically smart. It was fresh. All right? And it was a way for Nixon to claim, look, I am doing things in the area of civil rights. And unlike school desegregation, which was such an anathema to many whites, and affirmative action, which was another controversial program, this is a case where Nixon's political, practical, and philosophical motivations all went together in the same direction. And he acted forcefully. And he established the Office of Minority Business Enterprise in 1969 to coordinate the government's efforts here. And he established, and I want you to make a note of this, he established the first set-asides for minority-owned businesses. Okay? The first set-asides. Set-asides are when the federal government actually sets aside a certain number of contracts for certain kinds of firms or businesses, in this case, African-American and Hispanic-American, even Native American Indian-owned firms. So that is part of law today. That is something that is legal. That is something that is done. It is a kind of affirmative action, if you will, for businesses. And it starts with the Nixon administration. He also funneled money to historically black colleges. Okay, black colleges would have been the largest minority-owned enterprises in the country at that time, or some of the largest. And they would be supported by the administration with new grants. I think Nixon's unease with racial integration, right, with bringing blacks and whites together, allowed him to see the benefits of separate minority-owned and minority-run institutions, including Native American tribes. If I can just sort of summarize Nixon's civil rights program here in the couple minutes we have left, it is a kind of mixed record. You know, it's strong on substance. But then there was a failure of what some scholars called the rhetorical presidency. That is Nixon's aversion to giving at least one great speech on civil rights during his administration. You know, he didn't really have that. The closest he came to giving a strong pro-civil rights speech was a eulogy he made to Whitney Young, who was the late president of the Urban League. Young had died in an airplane crash not long after he struck this alliance with Nixon. And Nixon spoke at Young's graveside. It is speculated that he was the first U.S. president to speak at the graveside of a prominent African American. And the Chicago Defender wrote of the president, "He could not have spoken so movingly of Whitney Young's career as a civil rights leader unless he too had a vital personal stake in the struggle for equality." And Nixon handwrote the address. He wrote of Young, "He was a complex man, and he understood the complexities of the society in which he lived. Whitney Young will be remembered as a doer, not a talker." And this is the last point I'll leave you guys with. Who was Nixon talking about here when he said a doer and not a talker? You could say he was talking about Whitney Young. He very well may have been talking about himself. And one final word. Final quotation from Nixon from a 1973 letter. "When the historical record of the first 4 years is written, I'm confident it will show that this administration did far more in the fields of civil rights and equal opportunity than its critics were willing to admit." So that's something for you guys to ponder over. Hear how much words matter and how much deeds matter in the making of something like civil rights and civil rights policy. Okay, thank you all.
Next week on Lectures in History, Coppin State University history professor Roger Davidson discusses United States colored troops in the Civil War. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.